Welcome to a financial planning podcast with a down-to-earth vibe. Sasquatch listens while driving his EV to morning coffee. This is Through the Pines. On this episode, we will explore what to do when receiving an inheritance. So, pay off debt or invest it, hold on to a property or rent or liquidate. How long does a typical inheritance last? What are some of the inheritance's success stories we've seen? And how long does it take to get an inheritance after someone has passed? And then finally, let's chat about taxes and how those have an implication on our inheritance or an inheritance you may receive. So our advisors for this episode, we welcome back in studio Rex Baxter and Brandon Smith with PlanWithBaxter.com, 2023's, 2024's Forbes Best In-State Wealth Management Teams for Utah, Advisor Hub's fastest growing advisors to watch under $1 billion, and receivers of the Ameriprise Client Experience Award, which means they do know exactly what they are talking about. Thank you, Rex, Brandon, for joining us here on this podcast. Let's dive in. Let's start with, and it probably depends on how much inheritance you're getting, but it's money that you weren't necessarily planning on, we should say. And so do you immediately pay off debt or dive into investing? Who wants to tackle this first?
Well, I'll start. Thanks for having us, Brandon. I appreciate it. I think before we dig into that, let's just talk for a second about the different kinds of things we might receive as an inheritance.
Okay.
Right.
Like a car or cash.
Right.
Or,
so you might get personal property, which would be a car, a ring, you know, guns, art, an ATV, a side-by-side, whatever. Camp trailer, you know, things like that. And so
I would like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's personal property, and that is handled one way. So we'll come back to that. You might receive cash, checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs, non-retirement financial assets would be another category. Retirement assets like IRAs, Roth IRAs, annuities, whether they're tax qualified in an IRA or not tax qualified in an IRA. So we'll segregate that out as well. In addition to that, you may have real estate or business interest. And so we'll kind of break that out. And so let's kind of go through maybe each of those, and maybe each of those we can talk about how it passes through, what you should do with it, and how you might want to consider it and things to think about, and then the tax consequences of each as we go through.
Okay,
and that way people can kind of categorize it, I think, a little bit as we're going. So does that work?
It works for me. Do you want to start with just cash?
Yeah, cash is king.
Yeah.
I think we have a podcast name.
We do.
Okay.
We do.
Yeah. I think I've said that 5 podcasts in a row.
You got to keep saying it, though, because it's important.
Yeah, people might go back and check that podcast. So cash is king. So let's talk about cash, checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs.
Insurance?
And we'll handle insurance a little bit separately.
Okay.
And so let's talk about non-retirement accounts. And so do you want to start with that, Brandon?
Yeah. So like bank accounts.
Yeah.
Right. And I think shameless plug for our estate planning podcast on there and how to title those non-qualified accounts. But most of the time, right, you're going to receive a non-qualified account. Either it's held in joint name. We see that a lot where a parent will put a child on the name of the account. We usually don't recommend that. There's some legal liability on that. Not only that, if it passes to that child, you want that child to separate it between beneficiaries, they're not legally obligated to do that either, right? And so there are a couple downsides to having a joint name checking account, although we see it quite a bit. And the other one would be like a payable on death, right? And so once you pass away, it passes on to a beneficiary and then they receive it. And then it's theirs, right? If there is any gain in it, which is probably almost nothing, right? There's a step up in basis. And so they don't have any tax. I guess what I'm saying there's no taxability to that, unless of course that account's worth more than $13.61 million, which is probably not very likely.
No, but they
let's define what they need step to call up you. In basis too. And so you're right, 13 million, they need to call us.
Yeah.
But let's talk about, because step up in basis might be jargon for a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, and we'll probably talk about that quite a few times through this podcast. But when someone passes away, the assets receive what's called a step up in basis, or at least most of the assets do. And so this is most commonly in like a stock portfolio or any portfolio where there would be gains. Now, what that means is let's take, for example, a stock portfolio. If you've got a stock portfolio, you invest $100,000, it grows over the years to $150,000. If you sell that portfolio, you're gonna have $50,000 of capital gains that you then need to recognize and pay your capital gains tax on. The way the tax code is today, if you take that and it's given as an inheritance, the beneficiaries don't actually have to pay that capital gains tax. Mm-hmm. It's like they bought it on the date of the descendant's death, and that's how much they bought it for. And so if they turn around and sell it, they don't owe any capital gains tax on that. And so that's true of, you know, stock portfolios. That's true of real estate, mm-hmm. if it's passed correctly. And then, like I said, if there's a little bit of gain on those bank accounts, it's true of that as well.
So that's not a reason for everybody to run out and die just to get a step up the basis and not pay taxes.
Right.
And so, but that is, it is, you know, we always talk about death and taxes. And here is a way where people avoid taxes is by, you know, lots of times we have low cost basis stocks. Somebody bought Apple for $1 and wrote it up to $400 a share. Mm-hmm. And instead of selling that or giving it away during their lifetime, if they hold it and pass away with it, then they get that step up in basis and the entire family avoids the capital gains on that low cost basis stock. And so that can be a really powerful part of your strategy of creating wealth from generation to generation as people are inheriting money to kind of keep in mind.
So just to clear this up from my head. So if someone who has a lot of money in a stock portfolio and they're may pass away soon, the idea is not to clear out the stock portfolio to have cash on hand. It's to sort of keep it so that when it transfers, you miss that step up in basis. Is that what you're,
yeah.
Is that what you mean? Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly. And one other thing to remember on that is we want to invest with taxes in mind, but not necessarily let taxes drive the entire decision, right? Because you might have a ton of capital gains in one position, but that position, that stock might not be in a good place. Mm. And although we can save some capital gains if we hang on to it for 1, 2, 5, 10 years, mm-hmm. it's not worth letting an entire net worth collapse because something happens to one stock.
Gotcha.
And so you got to kind of weigh the pros and cons of, you know, what is the tax savings if we can hang on to this versus are we in a safe enough place with the rest of our financial plan that we can assume the amount of risk that it takes to hold on to it.
Okay. Yeah, paying 15% in capital gains tax is definitely less expensive than watching that stock go down by 30%.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, it's funny though, because Weaver States, that's kind of simple math. I understand for some people.
Yeah.
But
it does paralyze your mind sometimes when you think about paying that, I got to pay 15%. And then do you make weird decisions like that?
Absolutely. Because it plays that mental game of, oh, I'm going to be smart with my money. I'm going to avoid the 15%. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, the stock dropped and you're down 30%. Mm-hmm. And it would have been cheaper to sell it and pay.
Okay.
But sometimes we can choose, right, which stocks to sell. Sometimes some of them don't have as much, or maybe we just take half of them and recognize it for half of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so we can actually, there's a lot of options. And it's a really good conversation to have with your financial advisor and your accountant to make sure that you're making the right decision there.
Awesome. Let's talk about real estate, Rex.
So real estate is similar to a stock portfolio when it comes to inheritance, as far as taxes are concerned. Again, unless your estate is worth over that $13.6 million, you're not going to owe any death or estate taxes on your estate, on the real estate plus the investments, any of those pieces. But when you pass, your real estate, your house, your rental property, your business building, all of that will get a step up in basis to the valuation at the date of death or 6 months thereafter. There's a little known tax rule in there to where you can pick and choose which death date. You don't get to pick your death date, but which valuation date you get to use for the step up basis.
But on
real estate, you'd get a step up basis. The difficult thing on real estate is that it's illiquid, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're needing money to, you know, to pay down debt or to distribute, it's hard to divide a building or a house between mm-hmm. four kids or five mm-hmm. kids. It's very easy to divide a dollar or an investment portfolio amongst five kids. Mm-hmm. And so it gets a little bit trickier as far as division of assets and how you're doing that on the inheritance, because what happens is a lot of times people are saying, oh, you know, dad passed, mom passed, and we, you know, we've got $600,000 in this house and Susie wants her money. And so therefore we have to sell. Real estate's down. Joe doesn't want his money and he doesn't want to sell right now. Now all of a sudden we've got a family conflict of mm-hmm. do we sell while the market's down because we need to liquidate everything? Do we not? And what do we do with real estate there?
Brandon?
This is also a perfect time to talk about titling of real estate. That step up in basis happens only if it's passed a certain way, right? And so if it's passed, even if it goes through probate, that works, right? And you say they're the beneficiaries of my account, or if it's owned by a trust and the home is owned by a trust and then it passes that way, the beneficiaries get a step up in basis. So when they sell the house, even though, you know, mom bought it for $37,000 back in the day, mm-hmm. right? We get to sell it and it's like we had purchased it for the $500,000-$600,000. Mm-hmm. And so it gets that if it passes through probate, or it also gets that if it passes via trust. One thing we see is sometimes people will do joint ownership. They'll just put their kids on the name of the house. That way they avoid probate, right? And it passes right to the kids. The problem is they don't get that step up.
Oh my gosh, that's so much money. You lose.
Oh yeah, it's a huge deal. The other side, and we mentioned before, right? If those kids are maybe involved in a legal lawsuit or something, and mm-hmm. now all of a sudden they've got a home, an extra home, mom's house is part of their asset. And legally that could be on the line as well. And so we really discourage doing joint ownership of a home, but rather just pass it the correct way, which is usually through a trust.
So to clarify, like you said, Rex, you have this house mom bought for $37,000. It's now worth $600,000 and it's paid off. Mom passes. It goes to whoever the trust says it's supposed to go to, Jimmy or Susie. Now, can Susie sell it and then take the money? How does that work? How do you actually access the cash on that?
Yeah. Because it's owned by the trust, then the trustee has the ability to go down to the county recorder, change who the title is, and so they give it to Susie. And then it's Susie's asset. And mm-hmm. so Susie can sell it. She received that step up in basis up to $600,000. So she sells it for $620,000. She would pay capital gains on that $20,000 of gain from $600 to $620.
Okay.
Or if it was valued at $580,000,
yeah,
and she sold it for $580,000, she would actually take a tax loss for tax purposes. Mm. From 600 from that stepped up value down to the 580. But it would be her asset at that time to decide, do I want to liquidate it? Do I want to rent it? Do I want to move into it? What do I want to do with this house?
And that was, okay, so I was going to ask if there was a time limit on that, but it's essentially when you get it recorded, the value of it, and how do they determine the value of it?
No, the value is either at the date of death or at the 6 month thereafter mark. And when you select that date that you're using, that applies to all of the assets. You don't get to say, oh, I want this house to be valued six months from now. Yeah. I want this house to be valued today. I want, you know, you don't get to pick and choose. It's one or the other.
Okay.
And there's a couple other caveats there. And so typically you do want to work with an accountant and an advisor in order to make sure you understand all the nuances that go into that.
That's huge. I mean, that saves or you lose a ton of money on it.
Yeah, you figure 15% on $600,000.
Right.
Right. I mean, you're talking almost $100,000 in taxes that you save, because you didn't put your name on that title before your mom passed.
Wow. And people think, you know, they're doing the right thing, and lo and behold, it's...
Absolutely. And the right thing and the simple thing, they think, oh, this will be so much easier because I don't have to mm-hmm. do anything after mom mm-hmm. passed, and I can still take care of everything. And yet they don't understand the tax consequences of that if they get audited or the IRS ever looks into it or something like that.
Okay.
The trust has the flexibility to do whatever you want with the asset, meaning you can say, yeah, give my whole house to this one child and they can do what they want. But typically what we see is that the house is a part of the trust and you have a trustee, and the trustee is instructed to sell the house mm-hmm. within a reasonable time frame and divide the proceeds between the beneficiaries. And then they just split it. That's what we see the vast majority of the time. But a trust does have that flexibility. They can do whatever they want. Give the house to whoever they want.
Okay.
The other thing that we see in a trust a lot of times on inheritance of real estate is you can either, the trustee has the discretion of, look, if one of the kids wants to buy it, then let them use their inheritance. So let's say their inheritance portion is $200,000. Let them use that $200,000 of inheritance towards the purchase of the house. So then they're buying the house for $400,000 and it's worth $600,000. Because they're using their inheritance as to offset that.
Okay.
And so you have to be a little bit careful on how you do that, because you may have two kids that want the house or three kids. And so do you draw names out of a hat? Do you draw straws? And I've seen all of those things actually in practice, to where, you know, you flip a coin, you draw straws, you draw names, you draw a high card. I mean, I've seen all of those things written into the trust document as to how to break ties, which is interesting.
That would be quite the coin flip.
Yeah. No, I mean,
here's a $400,000 coin flip.
Oh boy, not good. Okay, let's talk businesses. You're going to inherit a business. How does that work?
Yeah, so lots of times that would be owned in an LLC or an S-Corp or something like that, and then your trust owns that LLC. And so, again, the trust is the owner of the LLC, and so it's handled by the trustee. It still flows through the trust document, and in the trust document itself, it determines should the business be sold, should it just be appraised and valued, and everybody owns an equal share of that business. And so you go through that estate planning process as to how that's going to be handled. But again, your ownership interest through the trust, you'll get that step up in basis as long as it's not over that $13.6 million on the business asset, whether it's, you know, goodwill, whether it's a building and land, whether it's accounts receivable, whether it's, you know, whatever that profit is in there, that gain in the business. Now, income is taxed differently. So the income that that business is generating will still be taxed as ordinary income that will flow through the trust or to the eventual beneficiaries. So.
Okay. Brandon?
The only thing, just maybe we should define this at the beginning, how a trust works, because if you're listening to the podcast Receiving Inheritance, oftentimes there's a trust involved. And so at its very, very most basic level, you have a grantor, right? Those are the people who put the money into the trust. Mm-hmm. They typically designate a trustee, a success. They're usually the trustee while they're alive. And then it's written in the trust, when they pass, we designate a successor trustee, usually a child, but it can be a corporation. I mean, you can select whoever you want. But that successor trustee isn't the beneficiary. The successor trustee is just simply assigned to distribute the assets to the beneficiaries, however the trust designates. And so it's actually really fairly efficient, clean process, right? Essentially, you're saying, hey, when I pass, this is what I want to have happen. I'm assigning this person to make sure that happens. That successor trustee, that person does that, divvies out the assets. If there is any contention on that, right, obviously beneficiaries can sue, right, and say, hey, you didn't divide this right. So that's where that check and balance comes in. But ultimately, it usually flows pretty smoothly because the grantors have designated exactly what they want to have happen with their assets and appointed someone with legal authority to now go and divide those assets.
Okay, so Rex, for our friends that do have a net worth of $13.65 million, at what point do they, I mean, they probably know all this, and they're sitting at, say, $15 million or something, and then do they, like, 2 years before try to get rid of some assets to take them under, or do they, like, how does that work?
So sometimes they know it, sometimes they don't. You'd be amazed at how few people are aware of what the tax laws actually are and how that works. And so you do get into different strategies at that point. And so, you know, it's 13.6 and change million per person. So I'm married. And so I could title half of my assets in my name, and I could title half of my assets in my wife's name. Now I would have a Rex trust and I would have a Jenny trust. But then I could protect
13.6.
What number are we dealing with?
13.6.
That would confuse everybody.
13.61. So each person gets the 13.61.
Gotcha.
And so a total of 27.22 million.
Oh, gotcha.
Right. But to Rex's point, right, you need to make sure. And so we usually use that 13 million as kind of a hurdle. As long as you're less than the 13 million based on current tax law, we don't have a lot of, like, death tax to worry. We really don't need to worry about the death tax. Obviously, it's always good to talk to an attorney and accountant, but really under that 13 million, we're not too worried. Once you're above that, like Rex says, it's per person, but you need to make sure you designate, and there's some things to do, right? If you're sitting at 17 million and one spouse passes, well, then this inheriting spouse gets it, but we need to make sure that that's divvied out and earmarked correctly so that both of you get to use that full tax exemption.
So, So I was reviewing one client's trust work here, maybe about 2 months ago or so. And net worth of about 15.6, right? So just about 2 million over that level. But everything is in his name and his trust. They've got one trust. It doesn't break into two upon the death. It's not what we would lovingly refer to as an AB bypass trust in the estate planning world. And so because of that, his family's at risk of owing taxes, death taxes on $2 million. At their second passing. And that tax is due in 9 months. And so if that's tied up in real estate, tied up in a business, you may have to do a fire sale to liquidate that money or get a loan very quickly to get the tax money within that 9 months. And so we needed to divide that up either during life or have it divided up upon the death as a testamentary trust to divide that to take advantage of the 13.6 for each of them. The other piece is that there's a lot of discussion in Congress, and who knows what happens, right? Nobody can predict that. But there's a lot of discussion that 13.6 gets reduced down to $5 million per person.
That's a huge reduction. Yeah. Wow.
And so that's where it was about 8 years ago or so. Hmm. And so as tax codes change at the end of the Trump tax cuts, the 2016 tax cuts, that may happen in 2026 where it goes down to that $5
million.
Mm-hmm. When I started in the business, $600,000 is what the level was for what it's worth.
Okay, so we hit on cash, we hit on real estate, and we hit on business. What are the other forms of inheritance we can
get? So let's talk life insurance, right? Okay. A lot of people have life insurance. And so, Brandon, do you want to talk?
Yeah.
Brandon's favorite.
Yeah.
It is not my favorite.
Oh, my bad.
But life insurance is the benefit of life insurance. The death benefit is actually tax-free. So that usually is good news to people that you receive that tax-free. Now, what you do with it, usually then we put it and we try and grow it, and then the growth on that is taxable. But the initial payout of the life insurance is tax-free.
Okay. Well, that was simple.
Yeah, that was easy, huh?
Brandon, do you have some more numbers?
You bet.
All right.
I thought this was kind of interesting. This is... Actually, let's do this one.
I love that preface, by the way, because do I say that every single time? It's getting. I think so, but I do want to hear like, well, this one's boring. I hope y'all like it. That maybe next time.
Okay. Here's a real mediocre stat for you. Okay. the number of 401k accounts worth more than $1 million at Fidelity. This was actually Yahoo Finance did this on from Fidelity. The number of 401ks worth more than $1 million jumped 41% in 2023, 299,000 to 422,000. Obviously, that's just at Fidelity, but they've got quite a few accounts there, right? And so that gives us a pretty good idea of how much is jumping. Part of that is the market, right? Markets ran really hard in 2023. Yep. And so we saw that. Now, the stats that are not mediocre, that are actually really interesting, the average 401k millionaire is 59 years old.
Huh?
And has been saving for 26 years.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Kind of a interesting insight into, you know, who's...
What's 59 minus 26 real quick? Because that's 30, the math on it.
33, right?
Yeah.
So they started around 33 years old and then they were a millionaire by the time they were 59 with Fidelity.
It's interesting how we all have a different takeaway. Your takeaway is people started at 33 to save in their 401k. My takeaway is there's 422,000 people that should be giving me a call. So, I mean, we all have a different thing.
That's pretty funny, right? Yeah. Planwithbaxter.com. If you're one of those, okay, let's dive into what in the heck do we do with our money? So now we got it. So do we pay off debt or invest it, Brandon?
Yeah, we, depends.
Okay. All right. Moving on. I'm just kidding.
We get this question a lot. Probably one of the most common questions when someone receives a large sum of money, no matter how that comes to be, is I've got this mortgage that's been hanging over me forever. I've got this credit card debt, or I've got these student loans, whatever it is. What should I do with that? And the answer truly is it depends. And what it depends on is a few things. First, and probably the most important consideration, is interest rates. What is the interest rate you're paying on your debt? And then second to that is what interest or what rate of return can we get on other investment choices? Whether that's you're going to go out and buy real estate, we're going to invest in the stock market, we're going to buy CDs or bond portfolio. What's that comparison? Because yes, there are some tax nuances, but by and large, especially with most people taking the standard deduction when they're filing their taxes, really it usually comes down to what is your interest rate. So let's say you've got a mortgage at 3%. Well, does it make sense to go pay off that mortgage with that money, or should we invest it at 8%? And the difference truly comes down to that differential, right? So if I'm going to pay off a mortgage at 3, or I could go out and get 8, well, there's a 5% spread on that, and that could be considerable. But then you also have to take into mind, man, that 3%, that's a guaranteed 3% that I don't have to pay, versus the market might fluctuate. And it will, not mine, it's your own personal
risk and what makes you feel better. And maybe you just want to get that paid.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Mm-hmm. Right. And I can't tell you how many financial plans I've had with people that we look at it and look at the hard numbers of it and say, yeah, you're better off to invest this at our assumed rate of return than you are to pay off the debt. And they say, yeah, but I can pay off the debt and that's going to feel good. And my retirement's still in place. And at that point, there's nothing wrong with it, right? You just need to be considerate of what are my options and what's going to make me feel most confident and most comfortable moving forward.
Rex?
There's two thoughts that come to mind. One is that typically people come to us looking for validation and they've already made their mind up.
Yeah.
You know, people mentally account for the money very early in this process.
How often do you change minds?
Sometimes, right? Sometimes, but it depends on how open they are, how open to receiving that information they are. Mm-hmm. And generally, it's a very emotional time in their lives. And so a lot of people are kind of closed off. And then a year from now, they're like, oh, financially, that may have been a better decision. so we do get a little bit of that. So that's one thing that comes to mind. And then the other is that we don't always make decisions purely for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what you guys were alluding to just a minute ago. What Brandon was saying is that even though financially we can talk to you and say, hey, look, financially, it really is probably better off to keep this loan that you have at 2.5% on your house and to earn 5% on a CD or put it into an investment portfolio that may average 6-7% over your lifetime with some big swings, but still average a higher rate. Financially, that's a much better decision. Emotionally, they may need that weight off their shoulders and that burden of having that debt on there. The difficulty is that then all of a sudden they wrap into their life that payment that they're making on their house into their lifestyle, and they may not have saved appropriately or set aside additional assets from the inheritance to accommodate for that increased lifestyle from paying off their house early. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple of integrated pieces that go into this that can make it a little more complex, which is why it's good to sit down and have an advisor or somebody that's unemotional about it go through that.
Yeah, because a lot of times if you just look at the numbers, like Rex said, let's say you've got a mortgage at 3%, and we know we can go buy a CD that's FDIC insured guaranteed as well at 5%. Well, that's a 2% spread. Mm-hmm. Let's say you've got $200,000 left on your house. That's $4,000 a year in extra money. Is $4,000 a year worth it, right? Is that something that is going to materially change your life? And some people might say no, right? Like $4,000 a month to feel debt-free, that's worth it. And other people might say, you know what? It's FDIC insured. I'd take a vacation with that. You know, let's go ahead and hold on to the mortgage. And really no right or wrong answer. Mm-hmm. Just comes down to, you know, what makes you feel better. And as long as it's within the parameters of a good financial plan, our future's, you know, taken care of.
So because I'm assuming you spend time on social media or even podcast listening. When you hear other advisors say, oh, always pay off debt first, or no, you can don't pay off your house, but you can invest it. And you can, like, what goes through your mind when you hear different advice from different financial advisors?
I cringe.
You cringe.
I just cringe because it does depend, and there's no right answer that is just blankets everybody. And there's definitely different personalities and that will say be debt free 100% of the time. That's always the right answer. You know, I'd never do anything else. And that's not always the right answer for everybody. Sometimes there's ways to leverage and to use debt for your benefit. And some people are comfortable with that risk, and that doesn't make it wrong. And you shouldn't feel guilty about that.
Yeah.
And so you should be able to go in and look at your own background, your own comfort levels, your own risk tolerance, and be able to make the decision that's right for you. And that may be retaining some of the debt and investing and capturing the difference. And it may not be. It may be paying off the debt because you know yourself well enough. And if you don't pay the debt off now, you may blow the $200,000 on frivolous things over the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yep. So
people love simple answers. And that's what a lot of the radio personality, things like that, just make it overly simple, which makes it really easy to understand and makes it like desirable for consumption. But unfortunately, it's sometimes the details that can really make life good.
PlanWithBaxter.com, Rex.
I love that. people love simple answers.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it the right answer.
Right.
Good to know. Okay, so let's move on to on your property. Now, you inherit a property. Should you, and this is going to be an it depends, but, you know, should you sell it? Should you rent it when you get a piece of property, a second house or something?
You stole our answer. It depends.
I know.
But yeah. No, I think one thing to think about when you're doing this, because everybody, oftentimes people are just so, they it's their childhood home. They're like, I don't want to give this up, right? Mm-hmm. What if we just rent it?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's not necessarily a bad answer, but there are a lot of things to consider, right? What happens when something breaks?
Yeah.
In fact, I was just working with a client on this the other week where they went in on a property, not their parents' property, but a property with a bunch of siblings. He's like, I'm not sure if we can go call everybody. If something major happens around Christmas, can we call everyone and say, hey, we need $2,000 from each of you because we had this repair or something, mm-hmm. you know, we need to do the roof or something like that. And so if you are thinking about co-owning property, it's really important to think about, well, who am I co-owning this with? And are they going to have the means, and how are we going to manage cash flow and all of those things? And so I wouldn't say that it's bad or always bad, but I would say that I've seen a lot of issues arise from that, just from discrepancies in what does need to be repaired versus what doesn't need to be repaired,
mm-hmm.
where money should be spent. Do we just hire a property manager? Sure, but those are expensive. And was this the right one? And so there's a lot of disagreements that come up with co-owning property that you need to make sure you think through before you jump into that.
So then if the trust says that one of the five siblings gets the home or the property, but the other four have to then get, I guess, the money that's in it, and so they need to refinance it. Do you see that often?
Yeah, I see that on occasions, and it's interesting because a lot of times parents want to do what's fair.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite estate planning attorneys, and I'll drop his name on here, Bryce Froer, Froer and Miles, right? His famous saying is that fair is where you sell pigs.
Right? Wow.
And there's no such thing as fair.
Okay.
And so, but you do see that sometimes to where one person will inherit the house and then they don't have the financial assets to pay off the other kids. And so then they have to take mm-hmm. out a mortgage. Well, there's no way to predict where interest rates will be when they inherit that asset and they have to take out a home equity loan or a primary mortgage on that house
mm-hmm.
in order to pay everybody else off. And then they've got this debt and they're uncomfortable with the debt. And obviously they, because it's now their house, they can sell it. Mm-hmm. But that was the whole goal, was to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting. I see one of the most common things regarding rentals that I see is regarding a cabin or a vacation property.
That makes sense.
And so I see that more often. And so I was working with one client here just this week, and she and her sister and her brother inherited a cabin up by Yellowstone. The one sister didn't want anything to do with it, and so the other two ended up buying her out.
Mm.
And that was a little bit of a financial difficulty for one of them, but they figured it out. They scraped up the dollars and was able to do that. But now they're running into the issue of, okay, well, who's going to go up and check the water pipes mm-hmm. throughout the winter?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to turn off the water and turn on the water? Who gets, you know, Labor Day weekend,
mm-hmm.
your family or my family?
Mm.
And now we're getting kids involved and grandkids. And so it can create some additional turmoil in the family when you end up keeping it. And do we do nightly rentals on it, where one is in a little tighter financial position, she could use the rental income
mm-hmm.
during the downtime, and the other one's like, I don't want anybody else in the cabin,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a family cabin. Dad built the rafters. I don't want anybody else in there damaging it. And so you get this dilemma that can cause conflict that mom and dad would have shuddered over, right? The last thing in the world they did was have this wonderful vacation property that now all of a sudden is tearing the family apart.
Oh. Yeah, that'd be terrible.
Right. And so you want to be able to make sure that you have open lines of communication, you're transparent about any agendas that you have or any issues that you're having with each other. And families struggle with that. They struggle opening up to each other and showing their weaknesses, whether it's, you know, selfishness of wanting the time or weaknesses of being in financial, you know, a little bit tighter than what other members of the family are. And so that can be difficult. And so you need to weigh that out when you're looking at retaining things in joint ownership or as a rental property or things along those lines. But part of that decision is where's real estate rates? You know, are we getting a high price for the property? Is it better to rent it out for 3 years and see if we can get through a down cycle in real estate? So that there's a lot of nuances that go into mm-hmm. that decision.
Okay, so this is an interesting question, Brandon. I like it because it's definitely a completely it depends answer, but I'm wondering if there are stats on it. So how long does a typical inheritance last? And obviously all the it depends on how big it is right. and all those other things. But I didn't know if there were stats on how fast people just blow through inheritances at all.
Does it depend on the size though?
I don't know.
That's a good question. Yeah.
I don't think it does.
Really?
Not really.
So you can blow through
$1 million.
$1 million as fast as you blow through 30,000 or something.
Yeah. So I know when I started in the business, I'd read a number of articles on that. And at that time, the average inheritance lasted a year and a half, like 18 months.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Oh my. I had no idea.
No, I'm not kidding.
Yes. Gotcha.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And that's regardless of the size of the.
That was regardless of size of the inheritance. Now, okay. And there may be exceptions, right? If you, mm-hmm. if you're inheriting $50 million.
Yeah.
And so I think on the extreme large size that there may be exceptions to that.
Okay.
But I think for the average person that is very, very common. And it is interesting because people come into it with great intentions, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to use this. I'm going to save it. And then all of a sudden the justifications follow shortly thereafter of, oh gosh, but I should replace my truck now because truck prices are going up. And this will be the last. How many times have you heard that, Brandon?
Yeah.
This will be the last truck I ever own. I can't tell you how many 60-year-olds I've heard that from.
Until they turn 63.
right.
So, okay.
Have you seen a stat more recent than that?
I did look around quite a bit. It's funny how stats are, right? Yeah. There were a lot out there, but most of them were 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 years.
That is wild.
Part of the question is, well, what defines lasting inheritance? Because my guess is a lot of it is going to just be pulling it out of an account and then paying down debt, right? Which is that wasted? No. Is it gone? No. You know, in a lot of senses, it's still there. But as I've watched it, it's amazing. You know, someone will have this account literally that they've built and maintained their entire life, and they pass it on to kids and it's gone, right? I mean, it's already been spent by the time we meet with them. And
we frequently talk about one of the most important numbers that our clients can watch and track over time, which is their net worth.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about how long does an inheritance last, I'm talking about that not increasing their net worth. And so their net worth is the same level a year and a half from now, roughly.
Right. As it was
pre-inheritance.
Because if you pay off the debt and your net worth goes up.
Then your net worth goes up. And so I truly believe that when I watch spending patterns on inheritance, I can't tell you. I mean, the Jeep market is hot. A lot of people love to buy Jeeps with inheritance money. And I'm a Jeep owner, so I can say this, but that may not be the best investment.
This Jeep's an investment. I get that argument. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. Very interesting. And then last one here, because we've talked about taxes and how that impacts you quite a bit. So how long does it take to get your inheritance after someone passes? And this is, assuming, depends on how it's structured most of the time, Brandon.
Yeah. Yep. And where it's at, right? Is it in real estate? And real estate, it depends. Some families are just like, let's sell this thing, you know, clean it out, list it for sale. Other families want to kind of fix things up, or they want to take time to go have all the family go through and take whatever is sentimental to them. And so real estate, though, that you're usually looking at a couple months, mm-hmm. you know, to get that sold. Investment accounts can go a little bit quicker. They can, you know, you still have to open a new account and have it settle over, but you're looking a few weeks, maybe a month or so. Bank accounts can be a little bit quicker than that, and so not too long usually. Okay. Go ahead and take that one, Rex.
I've seen some to where it's complex and we're dealing with other assets or a few side issues in the family, to where sometimes we've taken 3, 4, 5 years to settle an estate on occasions.
Okay.
And so, you know, it really can depend on what the assets are, what's going on in the family. We're dealing with businesses, real estate, and time of the trustee. Do they have time to deal with all of those issues immediately, or is there a reason for it to delay? things along those lines.
If you got your beneficiaries in line, if you got your estate planning paperwork in line, and all, then yeah, it usually goes pretty smooth. Obviously, there can always be exceptions, but usually pretty smooth. If it's going through probate, or you didn't have a beneficiary, which makes it go through probate, or you have fighting and things like that, then yeah, it can drag out to years.
I know we're running long on the podcast, but there's one asset out there that we've delayed talking about for a few minutes. And
pets?
This is intentional pets. As pets. No. It wasn't pets.
Okay.
Although pets are an issue.
Right.
And
right.
We haven't talked about that. Yeah. So that's,
stay tuned.
I guess we could. Yeah. Stay tuned for inheritance part two, the pets.
Yeah.
So no, it's annuities. We haven't talked much about annuities. And annuities are a little bit of their own animal.
I see what you did there.
Do you? Yeah, pets. That was good. Huh? So annuities are not inherently good or bad. They're just a product. And you'll hear us talk from time to time about annuities. In general, I feel like they get missold and misinterpreted extremely too frequently, in my opinion.
They're used way too often when they probably shouldn't have been.
Yeah, I think so. And so we don't talk about them a lot on here, although we probably will have a future episode on that. But in regards to inheritance, there's two different kinds of annuities. You have non-tax qualified annuities. So this would be a non-retirement annuity, one that's not in an IRA account. And when you're dealing with that, even though it's an insurance-based product, when that annuity pays out, let's say you put $50,000 in an annuity, it grew to $150,000 that's getting paid out, that comes out as income. And it either comes out to income to the trust at the trust income tax rates, which are extremely elevated, or it comes out as income to the beneficiaries in that year or spread out over a five-year period, depending upon the annuity company. And each contract is very unique. And so when you're dealing with annuities and inheritance, I cannot stress enough how important it probably is to work with an advisor to understand all of the different options before you take any action on the annuity, because that can jump your tax bracket for the year. It can cost you a lot of extra money, and that could be very easy to avoid. And so we want to make sure we look at that. If it's in a qualified account, in an IRA account, then it's very simple, because then it's in a tax qualified account. It can come out, it can get paid into an inherited IRA, and then it can be distributed over that 5 or 10 year periods that the IRS allows. And so the titling on the annuity, as far as what type of annuity, is going to be critical in that discussion with us.
Okay. Good stuff. And for more information, you can visit Rex Baxter and Brandon Smith with planwithbaxter.com at planwithbaxter.com. Thanks so much, Rex and Brandon, for being here today talking about what we do when we receive an inheritance. This has been Through the Pines, reminding you to use yesterday's dollars to finance tomorrow's dreams.